sound stuff this morning. Big giant red lights being like, fault, fault, fault. So the amplifier, something in the amplifier has blown. I don't know what it is. That's why the speakers are all weird. So if this just cuts out halfway through, now you'll know why. The amplifier back there is half broken. I don't exactly know what the problem is. It will be fixed. It's easy to fix because we have another amplifier. But that's why the speakers were weird this morning. And also, because of that, we have to turn it way up high to get it to register anything. So sometimes it gets a feedback loop going, and we have to turn it down again, but then you can't hear anything. So it's just a big, giant, complicated mess. So we'll have that fixed. I'll probably come up here this afternoon and fix that. It's just swapping out one piece of equipment for another. We're talking about the Old Testament today. The Old Testament occupies a strange space in the American Christian psyche, and it is the American Christian psyche. Although Western civilization in general has had this problem, but it is particularly prominent in the United States. This is, as an example of this, this is just a screenshot of an article. This is from 2013, so 4 years ago. But this is not the only thing like this, right? This sort of thing has happened a lot of different places where they put up the Ten Commandments near the Capitol, and the ACLU was challenging that because of, well, a number of things. I won't get into the whole thing. But this idea of the Ten Commandments placed in government buildings, the Old Testament, particularly in the American Christian sort of mindset, is a really weird thing. And it's led to a number of different sort of topics. One is America's relationship with Israel, because we have this idea that Israel as a nation holds a special prominence, and so we have to defend Israel because of the prophecies in the Old Testament, and so on and so forth. And again, it has particularly led to America into this certain, not all the time, but an unusual relationship with Israel in the way that people think about Israel. The concept of tithing. Well, again, a lot of different Christian groups today have this idea of tithing. Tithing being specifically the 10% rule. You have to give 10%. It does this sometimes. I don't know what it is. The Ten Commandments. Oh, we already talked about the Ten Commandments. Holding on to the Sabbath. And I've talked about this with a number of people who are trying to blend the Old Testament teaching with New Testament teaching. And one of the things that gets blended together is this idea of the Sabbath, specifically the seventh day. There's a group that specifically is called the Seventh-day Adventists that are trying to marry the teachings of the Old Testament with the teachings of the New Testament. And one of the hinge points of that ends up being the Sabbath. And you think about the Sabbath, particularly in Western civilization, having Saturday and Sunday off, that just wouldn't have been the case if we had been atheists this whole time. We have Saturday and Sunday off in large part because of the Christian leanings of the country and the way the country was established. Why would we have 2 days off a week? For most of history, people didn't get days off. You worked every day and that was the way it was. But in Western civilization, from about 200 AD onward, the way that Christianity has crept into Western civilization, even in the ways that we have days off. People in the first century, the Christians in the first century living in Rome, Rome did not care if you got Sunday off. Rome did not care if you got Saturday off. Now in Jerusalem, they would have cared about Saturday. Why? Because of the Sabbath. So people didn't work on the Sabbath. But Rome, who didn't care about Jehovah, why would they care if you get a day off to worship God? That's just not how they thought about things. We have at times, the Church of Christ, been accused of the church that doesn't believe in the Old Testament. And it's true, as you think about the balance of my teaching, and I would imagine teaching that you've had in the past from preachers and teachers, that we tend to focus on the New Testament. We don't teach as much out of the Old Testament. And as with most of the topics in this series, there needs to be a point of clarification. Because what does it mean to believe in the Old Testament? Do you believe that the things described in the Old Testament literally happened? Raise your hand if you do. I do. All of us believe in the Old Testament. And I would say even more so than a lot of different groups, we believe that the things in the Old Testament literally happened. Case in point is the story of Jonah, right? An Old Testament story that a lot of people have trouble accepting, which I think most of us would agree that the story of Jonah probably actually happened, literally happened. So in that way, I do believe in the Old Testament. But there are some key delineations that need to be made, points of clarification. One is factuality versus applicability. I can believe that the things in the Old Testament actually happened without believing they're directly applicable to me. So, for example, the teaching of all the different teachings about the sacrifices and the sacrificial system. Well, I think God actually literally told that to the children of Israel. That doesn't mean it applies to me. That doesn't mean that it's something that I have to obey as a commandment because God said it to the people in the Old Testament. The second thing is the Old Testament versus the Old Covenant. And this is an important point to make. The Old Testament is not the same thing as the Old Covenant. Specifically, the book Genesis through Malachi, all of the contents therein, are not the covenant that God made with Israel. The covenant that God specifically made with Israel, found in the books Exodus, generally speaking, Exodus through Deuteronomy, a lot of it contained in the prophets later on, the covenant, the terms of Israel's relationship with God, that's not the same thing as the Old Testament, the collection of books Genesis to Malachi. Those are not the same thing. So I can say I believe in the Old Testament. I think the things in the Old Testament actually happened. And I think on balance, the Old Testament is valuable for you and me without thinking that the Old Covenant, that is to say God's relationship with Israel, is still in effect, because I don't think the Old Covenant is still in effect. And it is true that I don't often teach directly out of the Old Testament. And when I say directly, what do I mean? That we're talking about things that are true. That's not a good way of saying that. We're talking about commandments that apply to you and me. There's a host of things we learn from the Old Testament. Not that many of them are directly applicable to you and me. That is to say that we do them because it says to do them in the Old Testament. So there's two things we're going to talk about today. One, why does the Old Covenant, again, keep that separation in your minds. The Old Testament is not the Old Covenant. Why does the Old Covenant not directly apply to God's people today? We could think about it in terms of the Israelite covenant, the Mosaic covenant, the Sinaitic covenant, the terms that were laid down at Mount Sinai. Second, what are the implications of this idea for the Ten Commandments, tithing, and the Sabbath? Because these are the three things that people get confused about the most. What do we do about the Ten Commandments? How applicable is the idea of tithing? And are we supposed to observe the Sabbath? These are three things that are found in the Old Covenant, the terms of God's relationship with the nation of Israel. So the question, do the laws that God laid down for Israel directly apply to the Christian? And the answer at surface level very easily is no. When was the last time you sacrificed a bull? When was the last time you brought an incense offering before the Lord? I would be shocked if anybody in this room has ever done that. Because you instinctively understand, yes, that the laws that God laid down for Israel do not apply to you. Galatians 3, and Galatians is the most important book when thinking about this topic. Galatians chapter 3. Beginning in verse 10, for all who rely on the works of the law are under a curse, for it is written, cursed is everyone who does not abide by all the things written in the book of the law and do them. Now it is evident that no one is justified before God by the law. No one. For the righteous shall live by faith, but the law is not of faith, rather the one who does them shall live by them. Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us, as it is written, cursed is everyone who hanged on a tree, so that in Christ Jesus the blessings of Abraham might come to the Gentiles, so that we might receive the promised Spirit through faith. It is evident that no one is justified before God by the law. Which means what? That if the law of Israel is directly applicable to you and me, you are not justified before God. You aren't. You can't be. We keep going in Galatians chapter 3, verse 23. Now, before faith came, we were held captive under the law. He's talking about we who? The Israelites. And in, I guess, a general sense, everybody. The idea of proselytization, that if you were not an Israelite, you could sort of be included in the old law. Imprisoned until the coming faith would be revealed, so that the law was our guardian until Christ came. Which means that what? Now that Christ has come, are we under that guardian? No, because it was our guardian until he came. Now he's come, that qualification has been fulfilled, so we are no longer under the guardian of the law in order that we might be justified by faith. now that faith has come, we are no longer under a guardian. He just says it flat out. We're not under that guardian. For in Christ Jesus, you are all sons of God through faith. For as many of you as were baptized into Christ and put on Christ, there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female. All are one in Christ Jesus. And if you are Christ's, then you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to the promise. And this is where that idea becomes very important. The difference between the Old Testament and the Old Covenant. Because God made promises to Abraham that fall outside the Old Covenant in Genesis. That is part of the Old Testament, the books of the Old Testament. But it falls outside of God's dealings with Israel. Why? Because Israel didn't exist yet, right? They all came from Abraham. So what is Paul saying here? We belong to that promise made to Abraham that is separate from the law that God revealed to Israel. Hebrews 8, 6 through 13, but as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry that is much more excellent than the old, as the covenant he mediates is better. Implying what? That there's two covenants. The covenant that Christ mediates and the covenant that he doesn't mediate. The one that he mediates, that Christ mediates, is better since it is enacted on better promises. For if the first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no need for a second, if that first covenant. What is he talking about? He's talking about that covenant made on Sinai. The covenant that he made in the Ten Commandments, and then he repeats later on in the book of Deuteronomy, if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no need to look for a second. He finds fault with them and he says, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will establish a new covenant with the house of Israel, with the house of Judah. And then he goes several verses down. We skip to verse 13. In speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first obsolete. What does obsolete mean? Useless, pointless, old, and outdated. And what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. What's his point in Hebrews chapter 8? And really the book of Hebrews in its entirety, Galatians and Hebrews kind of going together in this way. The old covenant, the covenant that God established with Israel, is no longer in effect. James 1, 22 through 25, be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like a man who looks intently at his natural face in a mirror, for he looks at himself and goes away and at once forgets what he was like. What is he talking about here? This idea of doing what the law says. In Galatians and Hebrews are pretty clear. No one's justified by doing the works of the law. But now that we're under the law of liberty, does that just mean we get to do whatever we want? Of course not. Don't be absurd. Be doers of the word. For the one who looks into the law of liberty, the perfect law, and perseveres, being a hearer, not a hearer who forgets, but a doer who acts, he will be blessed in his doing. The difference between the law of Israel and the law of liberty. Meaning what? That all of those restrictions in the old law, not all of them, but a lot of them have been relaxed and abolished and gotten rid of. But that doesn't mean we just get to do whatever we want. There are things that we have to do now, things that are instructed to us to do that we need to do, just not those particular things. So to reiterate here, I believe in the Old Testament, but it's clear that the way God interacted with Israel specifically is no longer in effect. It's not binding anymore. So what does that imply about these three things we've talked about, or the three things we've mentioned rather? What does that imply about the Ten Commandments, the idea of tithing, and the idea of the Sabbath? Because these are the three vestiges in Western civilization that people hold on to the most. So what does this mean about the Ten Commandments? Well, I'll put the Ten Commandments up here, right? This is from Exodus 20. There's another version that has, there's another place that has these commandments, but we'll use the Exodus 20 version. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself the carved image. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Remember the Sabbath, keep it holy. Honor your father and mother. You shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery or steal or bear false witness or covet. Now, I've abbreviated these quite obviously because the text is rather long in Exodus 20. Looking at these, how many of these do we do? Don't we do 9 of these? Sure we do. There's 9 of these things that we absolutely believe that we need to follow. There's one that we don't, which is what? Remember the Sabbath and keep it holy. But here's my point in this. We are bound by 9 of the 10 commandments, but not because God commanded them on Sinai. you look back at these 10 things, 9 of these are repeated in the New Testament. The writers of the New Testament, as they're laying down the commandments for God's people, those things that James says you need to hear and do, 9 of these are repeated as instructions for the church in the New Testament. Why do I do them? Not because God commanded them on Sinai, but because God's apostles commanded them in the New Testament. That's why I do them. And which one did they not command for me to do? To remember the Sabbath and to keep it holy. So I don't do that. So the Ten Commandments, this idea of the Ten Commandments, we need to get away from this idea. The Ten Commandments are not binding on you and me. It just so happens that 9 of the 10 are repeated in the instructions that are binding for you and me. The Ten Commandments themselves have no weight today. What about the Sabbath then? As we've said, the command to keep the Sabbath is not commanded in the New Testament. Exodus 28 through 11, this is in that original Ten Commandments. Remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, your livestock, the sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth and sea and all that is in them and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Why did the Sabbath matter? He points back to an event, creation, and draws a commandment from that event. The event being the seventh day, God rested. We read that in Genesis. Two chapters of Genesis. So remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy because the Lord rested on the Sabbath. Why don't we do that? You do work on the Sabbath, I know you do. And Jesus, as he's pointing out with all of the disputes between the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sadducees, a lot of disputes in the Gospels about the Sabbath. And yet, what do we find in the New Testament? Acts 20, verse 7, on the first day of the week when we were gathered to break bread, Paul talked to them, intending to depart the next day and prolong his speech until midnight. I won't do that. 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2, now concerning the collection for the saints, as I directed the churches of Galatia, so you also are to do on the first day of every week. Each of you is to put something aside. If the Sabbath is so important, why does the first century church seem to care so much about the first day of the week? And never do they mention resting on the seventh, or meeting on the seventh, or gathering on the seventh. Why focus on the first day of the week? Well, like the Sabbath, was drawn from an event that had significance to Israel, the creation of the world, and God draws this lesson from that specific event. There is an event that the apostles draw from as the instruction for the church. Mark 16:9, now when he rose early on the first day of the week. Like in the Old Testament, God commanded them to observe the Sabbath because of an event that God had done, resting on the seventh day of creation. In the New Testament, the New Covenant, the law of liberty, the example is to meet on the first day of the week. Why? Because that's when Jesus rose from the dead. That is the most significant event in the history of the world. So we honor that on the first day of the week, not the Sabbath. And this is another example of the strange intersection of Christianity and Western civilization. And I said this already. I pointed this out at the beginning of the lesson. If you're Rome, you care that the Christians want to meet on the first day of the week? No. You're working. You got work to do. And if you're a slave owner, do you want your slave to just take a day off? Probably not. We live in a civilization that happens to have the first day of the week as one of the days off. For a lot of, not everybody, but for a lot of people. And as culture drifts from Christian roots, because there are a lot of Christian roots within Western civilization, as culture drifts farther and farther from that, the idea of taking Sunday off to do anything, just restful, becomes a stranger and stranger idea. You see this more and more businesses staying open on Sunday, which is how it would have been for most of history. We happen to live in a society where a lot of people don't work on Sunday, but that has not always been the case for God's people, and they had to make it work. So what about tithing? The last thing we're going to look at this morning. What about tithing? The idea of tithing, I get asked fairly frequently about tithing. Why don't we do this? Because I don't think anybody, well, I hope at least, I hope that nobody has ever commanded you to give a certain percentage. Because that's not in the New Testament, right? The idea of tithing comes from Leviticus 27, verse 30. Every tithe of the land, whether the seed or the land or the fruit or the trees, is the Lord's. It is holy to the Lord. Now, this also came up earlier on when Abraham tithed to Melchizedek. Inherent in the word tithe is the concept of a tenth. That's what the word tithe means. Every tenth of the land would be a valid translation of this passage. Every tenth of the land is the Lord's. But when we come to the New Testament, 1 Corinthians 16:2, on the first day of the week, each of you is to put something aside and store it up as he may prosper, so there will be no collecting when I come. He says in 2 Corinthians 9, the point is this, whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly. Whoever sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. Each one must give as he has decided in his heart. And it's interesting what he says right after that. Not reluctantly or under compulsion. Israel was under compulsion. There was no ifs, ands, or buts about it. You're giving a tenth and that's the way it is. That was under compulsion for the Israelites. We come to the New Testament and Paul does not give anything near so specific. Why don't we instruct our members to give 10%? Because the apostles did not instruct the first century Christians to give 10%. What was the principle? Give as you have prospered and give bountifully. The one who sows sparingly will also reap sparingly. Give cheerfully. And if we're going to say one thing, the thing that Jesus commends of giving more than anything else, that the story of the widow with the two mites, what did Jesus commend? The woman who gave 100%, which is way more than 10%, right? So if there's any principle at all in the New Testament, it's give more. Give more generously. Give as much as you can. And if that happens to be 10%, okay, that's fine. If it happens to be 20%, well, great. Give cheerfully as you have decided in your heart. This goes back to the idea of the law of liberty, right? Do not abuse the law of liberty. Do not continue to live in sin now that you're under this law of liberty. God's relaxed a lot of the specific restraints on his people, the specific commandments of the way he wants us to live. And how are we supposed to use that law of liberty? Now, instead of giving 10%, I can give more than that. I need to be willing to use this law of freedom to give generously and cheerfully. It's not about giving 10% as much as it's about giving cheerfully to the Lord. So does that mean I don't think the Old Testament holds value? Of course not. The Old Testament holds plenty of value. And it's in the reading that was read for us this morning. Romans 15:3 through 4. For Christ did not please himself, but that, as it is written, the reproaches of those who reproached you fell on me. For whatever was written in former days, that's the Old Testament, was written for our instruction, that through endurance and through the encouragement of the scriptures, we might have hope. In this passage, Romans 15 specifically, the encouragement of the scriptures is all those things about Christ and why Christ matters so much and why Christ was so important. And that's encouraging to you and me now that we know that Christ has come. 1 Corinthians 10:6 through 13, these things took place, all the things written in the Old Testament, as examples for us. They don't apply directly, but they absolutely apply indirectly. They absolutely have some benefit for you and me as we're reading through the Old Testament, so that we might not desire evil as they did. Do not be idolaters, as some of them were, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. That's a repetition of that one of the Ten Commandments. We must not indulge in sexual immorality, as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in a single day. Do not put Christ to the test, as some of them did and were destroyed by serpents, nor grumble, as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now, these things happened to them as an example. Example of what? This is how God views sin. And this is what God's going to do to you if you sin. Not literally, right? Because people do all sorts of things and they're out. Some serpents don't come out of the ground and destroy them. The earth does not swallow them up and swallow them whole. But what is the point, the example that we're learning? That this is how God views your sin. And this is his attitude toward that sin. He may be allowing you through the law of liberty to exercise some liberty more than the Israelites. But even if he doesn't strike you dead on the spot, rest assured that vengeance will come. Now, these things happened for them as an example, but they were written down for our instruction on whom the end of the ages has come. And then this idea of the temptation, and this is an important point about the temptation. Therefore, let anyone who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. No temptation is overtaking you that is not common to man. How do I know that? I can read the Old Testament and see all the same temptations. I can read the Old Testament and see that they struggled with all the same stuff that I struggled with. Maybe the specifics are different. Indeed, they are. But the temptation to sexual immorality, to idolatry, the temptation to treat one another poorly, the temptation to greed, the temptation to fill in the blank. They all faced those same temptations. No temptation is overtaking you that is not common to man. God is faithful and will not let you be tempted beyond your ability, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape. You may be able to endure it. What do I need to know from the Old Testament? How does God deal with sin? What does God care about in his people? And what are the consequences for violating God's instruction? We learn what God is like. What are his characteristics? I see that throughout the Old Testament. The faithfulness and the love and the wrath and the justice and the mercy. All of God's characteristics on display in his dealings with Israel. How does God feel about sin? How does God interact with his creation? What did he interact with them? Through the written word, through the messages of the prophets. He didn't want them to just be unknowing about him, but he revealed himself to them, right? We're learning that about God. Why is the Christ so important? Where did he come from? You cannot understand the New Testament if you've not understood the Old Testament. Because all the stuff about Christ and the Messiah and why he matters so much, all of that's found in the Old Testament. You can't understand the new until you understand the old. Not to mention a host of secondary and tertiary pieces of information on and on and on throughout the Old Testament. So, of course, it's not that the Old Testament has no value, and it's not that I don't believe in the Old Testament. It is specifically that the way that God dealt with Israel, the instructions that he had for Israel, no longer apply to us. A lot of those things are repeated, but not all of them. We'll end with Acts chapter 17, verse 29. We, being then God's offspring, ought not to think that the divine is like the gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art or imagination of man. The times of ignorance, the times in the Old Testament when God dealt directly with Israel, the times when the Gentiles, for the most part, had no idea who God was, these times of ignorance God overlooked, but now what? He commands all people everywhere to repent. Ignorance is no longer an excuse, guys. Because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man who he has appointed, and of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. And then what did Jesus do? He left the apostles and the prophets to instruct us in how we might avoid condemnation.